Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode number 93, titled The Buddha's Reputation of Suffering.
Even to do it in a simplified form. Okay, now, in case you've heard, maybe do some of you feel that the Shakyamuni Buddha, who are new to Buddhism or have just heard something about it, that his great discovery was suffering? How many people think that Buddha's big thing was suffering? Good. Glad. There's somebody. Because actually that's a huge reputation. Why? Because Buddha, you know, Shakyamuni Buddha was a very remarkable person, apparently. And he was a layperson until he was almost 30. And he therefore experienced all kinds of things and learned lots of things. And had tremendous amount of mundane pleasure. And because his father had had a prophecy at birth from a sage, an Indian guru sage who came to see the baby, knowing by clairvoyance that some extraordinary being had been born, came to examine him. And then the minute he finished examining, he burst into tears. And then the father was worried at first, why is it something ill-fated about this child? And the guy said, no, but it says that this child is going to become a perfect, unexcelled, enlightened Buddha, awakened one, enlightened one. And I'll be passed away before that happens because he was an elderly sage. So I won't get to be living at the time when his field is expanded to embrace all beings. And so he wept. But the father didn't really hear that carefully. He says, what, Buddha? He's a prince, you know. And then the sage, in order to give the father something to work on, he said, well, if he can be kept in the home life, in the layman's life, up until his like full maturity, then he'll be a world-conquering king. Oh, the father really liked that idea. But if he leaves the home life to seek, becomes a shramana, a seeker of the highest truth, he'll become a perfect enlightened Buddha. And so the father then, oh, okay, I have a plan. I'm going to keep him in the home life by making it really a super pleasure palace home life. So that was the father's whole work. And for 29 years. And then he, at the age of 29 years, they say, which is not very realistic, the story, that he finally escaped from his pleasure palace and he went around to see the way life really was among the people. And the father tried to make a Potemkin city and countryside where everything would seem perfectly, everyone would be happy, tried to hide any old people, sick people, dead people, you know, poverty, you know, anything unpleasant. But somehow the reality broke through and the Buddha met successively an old person, a sick person, a dead body, a funeral. And then finally he met an ascetic, a seeker, a shramana, someone who was seeking a yogi, you know, someone seeking the nature of reality. And seeking freedom, seeking truth, who had a kind of special light about him. So he had those four sights, they're called. And then that made him decide that he wanted to do something about that reality. And he couldn't do that as a king. So then a little bit after that, he had a son born to he and his beloved wife. They had a son. And what that signaled in the Indian family system was the father would abdicate and go into retreat, go to Florida, go into retirement, and the son would take over the responsibility of running the kingdom. And so then he declined the father's request, and he said, I'm sorry, Dad, I'm not, because, you know, I'm trained to be a king, and king is supposed to protect his subjects and his citizens. But I see the real enemies of my subjects are old age, sickness, death, and meaningfulness. You know? And I, as a king, I can't really help them with that. And the father said, oh, don't do that. The priests, you know, the Vedic priests, they take care of that stuff. You know, you don't worry about that. You deal with health, education, welfare, and defense. And he said, well, that's not really helping my people. They're what really bothers them. It's so nice to be able to do that, but I'm not getting at their real problems. And so he refused, and then the father did what fathers do. He locked him up and sent in the shrinks. And Buddha then did what enterprising young people do. He escaped. And he was sad, leaving his wife and child, but he wasn't really sad because, of course, he had a certain kind of very strong personality and intelligence, and he was pretty sure he was going to find something that would be more beneficial to them than just taking them to the fairground and, you know, household matters, you know. And he escaped anyway. He cut his hair, gave off his jewels, gave back his horse. It was a big trauma and the thing. And then he went and he more or less tormented himself for 6 years. And he tried to do with it sort of the opposite contrast of self-indulgence, self-mortification. He did intense and extreme self-mortification, because actually a lot of the seekers in his time who dropped out of the Vedic culture were going, mostly males and mostly Brahmins, upper class people, a few warrior caste people like himself, but they were doing this kind of, and you know, tremendous austerities to sort of get their minds out of their bodies, you know, chittavritti nirodha, you know, and stop the mind, you know, and leave the world, you know, and go to a higher world. That's really the main drive, you know. You can find it in the Sankhya philosophy, in most of the early Indian dualist philosophies, where salvation from. Sorry. Salvation from the suffering of a kind of samsara world, which they all knew about. He didn't invent that or discover that. Any idiot knows about suffering. Just stub your toe and you know about suffering. And so he was sort of outdoing them all just to show that he could do all of that. And then about 6 years later, he reached a point where he said, I still am not satisfied with what I have. And don't make a mistake, he also attained during that period what are called the four formless states or the four immaterial states, which are described as, their names of them are the state of infinite space, the state of infinite consciousness, the state of absolute nothingness, and the state of, it isn't nothing, but it's a state, mental state of that seems to be absolute nothingness, and a state beyond consciousness and unconsciousness. These are called the four immaterial states, and they're amazing meditative realms. And he had attained those, but he wasn't satisfied that those were ultimate reality. That, you know, some state of, in a way, obliteration, you could say, was the solution to the world. It certainly obliterated your experience of relational suffering, but because you were in this kind of almost extinguished type of state. But he was not satisfied that was an ultimate reality. Because why? Because he achieved it through a causal process and of developing certain meditative adeptness and stability of concentration and so on, extraordinary stability and withdrawal from any attention to sense data and all this, and attachment to the body. And but since it was a caused state and it was also experienced as apart from the rest of the relativity, it was a relative state. This is a pretty obvious thing, actually. Even though in that state, it seems if you become infinite space, and it isn't like he's floating, like a little yogi sitting cross-legged is floating in infinite space. You lose your body entirely, and you are just the infinite space. And then your consciousness expands into it as infinite consciousness. And then that's too tiresome, and then you just pass out into absolute nothingness, what seems to be. And then you go to something which is both nothing and something, the most subtle state. And but all of them are just states, and they're therefore relational states, although when you're in them, they seem to be absolute. It seems like there's nothing else. But he was too smart to... But you do come back from them, actually, sooner or later. And he was too intelligent to be confused and think they were ultimate reality, which actually, unfortunately, many mystics do get confused and do think such obliterated states are like that. And even many Buddhists think that nirvana is such a state, even though even in Theravada Buddhism, Buddha was very clear that there's no such nirvana outside of the relational world, some state of obliteratedness. He never would say that nirvana. And he clearly said nirvana is none of those four states. He very clearly said that many times. Even in that form of Buddhism where he allowed or encouraged even people to think that there was a kind of escape state. Okay, but anyway, he was unsatisfied as far as having a complete understanding of the universe. And he thought, well, the reason is I'm still attached to my body in some subtle way, because even when I go into those trance states, my body's still breathing. So I'm going to stop my breathing and do without breathing. That'll be the last attachment I'll give up. Even that subtle breathing that a yogi can get into in what is called cataleptic trance, where they're almost like hibernating, they're hardly breathing, but they're still some in and out of oxygen, you know, to keep their cells alive, you know. So then he was doing that. And then in the version of the Buddha's life that I like best, in the exoteric version, he passes out and a young village girl finds him and feeds him and takes care of him. And then he recovers his health. And then he gets enlightened. He kind of bags all the suffering and he gets enlightened. But in the one that I like better, the tantric one, esoteric one, he hears a finger snapping in front of him. And there's a beautiful goddess there, a female Buddha. And she says, what are you doing? You're going to choke yourself like that. You're not going to get anywhere with that. Come with me. And instead, and his subtle body rises out of his entranced body and goes with her to the Brahma heaven, highest Brahma heaven. And there he's initiated into a mandala of the esoteric Buddha community mandala. And that's why when he comes back from that, then he gets a feeling of, he really recognizes the nature of reality through that, through within that space. And then when he comes back, his body immediately fills out, he's healthy, has a golden light about him and all this. You know, which, you know, he wouldn't get that after 6 years of self-torture just by eating a bowl of rice in the exoteric story. Well, I don't like that story that much. That would be one super duper vegan, no gluten rice, where one bowl took a skeleton. And there are amazing sculptures of the Buddha from that time of this supreme extreme asceticism, where he says, you know, when he exhaled and his stomach wall would go back, it would touch the spine, you know, and it shows the skeletal structure. It's amazing looking. Best one is in Lahore, actually, from Gandhara in Pakistan, which I hope they haven't destroyed. And Dalai Lama has one of those in his own meditation room. An image, a copy of it. So then he spent 49 days hanging out in the grove there and not talking to anybody except the gods. And Brahma, and he had a big dialogue about whether he should try to teach humans. And Brahma persuaded him to do so. And Brahma was very anxious that he tell humans that he, Brahma, was not omnipotent and didn't create them. Because they thought he was, some of them, at the time. And he wanted Buddha to explain to them that God didn't create them. Because Brahma admitted, he said, I don't mind when they're having a good time and they praise me for creating them. But when they have horrible misery and their children die or they're tortured or terrible things happen to them, then they're mad at me and then I get a really bad vibe and I don't like that. So I'd rather have us be working on it together. I am God, I'm really powerful, I'm Brahma, and I like to help. But I'm very competent in helping. But I need someone who they might think was reasonable to to teach them that I don't control their fate. We all have a mutual karma. They control their own fate to some extent, all interactively. It's in the Buddhist text from 2,500 years ago, such a dialogue. Very different from the burning bush dialogue. So he stays there. And then he decides he's going to go teach these five guys who had joined him in his super mortifying 6 years, but who had abandoned him with disgust when they saw him suddenly fill out, turn gold and all clean, wash his robe, cut his fingernails, trim his hair, and he looked kind of neat and healthy. And they were really disgusted. They said, he's caved in, you know, he's caved. He's not like a macho Zen guy like us, you know. So they had left. So he went to teach them. But this is the main point of today, this first lesson today. He then taught something called the Four Noble Truths. It's usually called Four Noble Truths. But you could call that satya, it's truth. But satya, that means also reality in Sanskrit. It also means a fact, a satya. It means what is, you know. Truth, the problem with that is it's like a proposition. And the reason the 19th century English translators of Buddhism translated, I think, as Four Noble Truths is that they wanted to find in Buddhism something like a credo, because they thought it was a religion mainly, and they wanted something there. And religion has to have a credo, that a dogmatic doctrine or belief that you must subscribe to, and then that will make you a religious fanatic like us. And you know, they didn't want to say these are just four facts. And actually, the Four Noble Truths or Four Noble Facts, Four Noble Realities, are actually like a medical prescription rather than a bunch of dogmas. And the real discovery is the third one. The only one that's really real is the third one, Nirvana. So, and this is the main point I want to make to you, all those of you who are new to it, middle to it, and the experts won't mind. The real discovery is Nirvana. And Nirvana is the only one that's real. The suffering is not really real. It's not totally non-existent, but it's not really real. The cause of the suffering is not really real, but it's only relatively real, only it's illusorily real. And even the path to overcome the suffering, relational path to overcome suffering, is only relatively real. The only thing that's really real is Nirvana. This is the Buddha's teaching. What does that mean? Now, that would sound also, if you take it in a dualistic sense, that sounds very world-negating, which is how people in the West have understood Buddhism, basically. But that sounds bad. It's like, all this is sucks and it's all unreal. It's terrible. But there's some other thing somewhere else that's really great. That's Nirvana. And that's actually rightly considered unrealistic, such an idea. Because anybody in common sense can think, if there's another reality that is separate from this reality, it cannot be the absolute reality because it has a boundary between it and this reality, a difference. So that makes it relational. Do you follow me? So for Nirvana to be the really real reality, it's right here. It's what this really is. Do you follow me? So it's actually non-dual from the very beginning. And that's why he very carefully stated all of those states, which are, you can't really think of another state. If you have an abstract idea that ultimate reality is some separate, extinguished thing, infinite space, infinite consciousness, absolute nothingness, and somehow beyond either one, nothingness or somethingness, beyond consciousness or unconsciousness, that's a pretty exhaustive list. What else would be an extinguished state? But no, those are only mental states, though. So he clearly says right at the beginning, that's not Nirvana. None of them are Nirvana. Don't be trapped by them if you reach one, if you become a meditative adept and reach one. In fact, they're traps, actually. Because the person who wrongly thinks, now I'm the absolute, that person will become a deity of the absolute formless state for billions of kalpas, you know, hundreds of big bangs and big crunches, but they don't have bangs in India. They have kind of, you know, I don't know, like blossomings, you know, big blossomings. and big crunches. And and then you come down and you don't know where your boyfriend is or your girlfriend or your husband or your mother or your father or your child. They're all gone. And you're still, because that, you know, I'm extinguished, it's great, but you only say that at the threshold, because when you're in infinite space state, you feel you are infinite space. You don't have a body, you don't have a tongue, and you don't talk. You don't have language. And so you could really be trapped if you're not aware, if you're not prepared to know that any state is just that, a state, a relative state. And nirvana is something different, more subtle. Here we are in nirvana. You're not even smiling. Why? And that's very interesting. Why are we not smiling? We hear we are nirvana. We go, huh? What? Yeah, we don't smile. Why? What do we think the ultimate reality is? And why do we think so? Well, actually, if we are properly educated, as I'm sure all of you are, in a modern way, our reality sense has come from science classes, from people who work at MIT and Harvard and Columbia and whatever, you know, and who write, like, science books. And they guarantee us that future life is a religious fanatic superstition of some people who are unrealistically refusing to face, like, grown-up Jean-Paul Sartre, you know, a little bit of absinthe, Gauloise, Café Le Domago. I'm bravely going to be nothing. Kidding themselves. What's brave about being nothing? Nothing brave about it. It's like, let me out of here. I'll come drill your tooth. And you say, let me be nothing. That's not brave. You want to be anesthetized. Nothing is anesthetized. There's no consequence to whatever you did. You can be Stalin, kill 30 million people, or Mao, or Hitler, and you'll just be nothing. Fine. You don't have to be brave to be nothing, especially not when you're old and you have arthritis. Give me some Celebrex. That's just a little foretaste of nothing. I don't care. It's going to explode my heart later. I'm going to take it now. All those guys out there in Phoenix voting for change. More tax cuts, that means. Never mind. So that's change. So the point is, we are conditioned. That's the comforting thing, is that we're nothing. That's one level, that's one major main level of our conditioning. We commonsensically and consensually, our reality is that we only have to worry about getting from here to the, you know, evergreen fair lawn in New Jersey cemetery plot. As long as we can pay for all of that, and we have our elder care, and we have everything, and insurance, and Social Security, thank you, Paul Ryan, etc., we are fine. And we don't have to worry about after that. That's our consensual reality. And that's comforting to us, because the underlying reality is, again, why don't we smile when we hear this is nirvana? Underlying reality is hell on earth, under the earth, actually. Hell, you know, suffering, terrible. What could happen? We don't know. The aliens will get us. You know, that dark room, you go in there, and the thing is in there. When I was a little boy, I was really scared of the thing. And some kid in my neighborhood on 81st Street was found outside the thing, almost ready to, like, jump out of his building. It was that kind of big, ugly walking carrot, the early version of the thing. It's like a giant carrot was going to eat you. And the first time they made it. So we're conditioned to be frightened, in other words. The default reality and the spiritual side underneath from all the world religions, actually, unfortunately, too much, even Buddhists can be distorted that way, is that there's going to be a horrible future life waiting for you. And so stay alive as long as you can, and pay your dues at the temple or the church or whatever. And even if you're, and that's why the convinced materialist, like my 97-year-old grandfather, he was calling for the minister, even though he totally didn't believe in any sort of spirit or soul or future life. But when he was at the death door, he still called for one, just to hedge his bets. That it was, he couldn't count on a safe nothingness. Because nothingness is safe, are you kidding? That's why our culture is so reckless. That's why we're destroying the planet. Just turn on the electric switch, turn it on, yeah, more. Oh, no, climate change, who cares? Après moi le déluge, the famous French statement, you know. Flood comes after me. From these elder guys in Dallas, Texas, who own these oil wells, and in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and Kansas, putting the pipe through the upper reaches of the Missouri watershed. Because they... dead, and there's no consequence. If they wrecked all of the other, how many lives they wrecked, there's no consequence. So, anyway, never mind about that. Point is, this is nirvana. So the default thing, if you're a being who's able to really let go, in short, really let go of everything, like let it all go, if you're capable of that, then you're going to be born up in an ocean of bliss. Suffering is only caused by fear, fear of the other. So let's go back to the Four Noble Truths. I'll explain it. I'll come back around to nirvana. I just wanted to mention, it's all right. It's all nirvana. It's the default situation. You know, be here now, therefore, was such a great thing. That dear old Baba Ramdas, Dr. Richard Alpert, in the sense that what's really here now is nirvana. If you're really capable of letting yourself completely go and really give yourself to here now, completely. You know, like they say in the rap world or the hip-hop world, give it up for so-and-so, you know. They mean clapping. But that's, they have such wonderful expressions. Give it up. You know, you just ready. If you can really give it up, even death is not a problem. And you'll be born up in a, you know, by angels, no question. Because there are plenty of beings who know that it's nirvana now, and those are the ones who love everybody. Why are they capable of loving everybody? Because they feel nirvana in their bones. And not only do they feel nirvana in their bones, but they see you nirvana in your bones. They actually see you as a beautiful configuration of infinite bliss energy. That's how an enlightened person sees another person at the reality level. But that enlightened person also does not disregard, because they fully see the other person, that the other person doesn't see themselves that way. The other person is like, oh, who, me? No, I'm not bliss. Bliss, that might be a germ. If I was all open, I might get sick. You know, there's a boundary between me and the universe. I don't want to be infected by the universe. That's a deeper feeling everybody has. That's the second noble truth. Okay, first noble truth is, anybody who is ignorant of their own true reality, which is nirvana, actually, which is freedom, which is bliss, but anybody who doesn't know that is going to suffer. And any state they can reach while still not knowing their true nature will be inherently suffering. Even pleasure is called the suffering of change, because it doesn't last. It's like, somebody has always wanted to be in the White House because they're white. And they think, or they're not white, and they think it's going to be great in the White House. And we've all seen, those of us who are older, I'm not picking on any particular one. We've all seen every single one of them. Within a few months, they have a press, they come out having a press conference. It's, their hair is more white. They're like deer in the headlights. They're like, I have power. What? Power for what? Power to absorb this. See, Louis C.K., he made a great little talk on Conan about a month ago. And he said, what are presidents for? They only serve for everybody to dump all their annoyance on them. They're just punching bags. You know? What do we do with our leaders? We want to, when they put them in there, then what do we say? Oh, they ruined everything. They're horrible. They're no good. They suck. And then it was going bleep, bleep, bleep. So you don't know really what he said. And then he said, they suck, so they have to be able to take criticism, he said. That's a very important quality in a leader. So in other words, or you win a gold medal in the Olympics. You train, and you're really happy you got that gold medal. Play the anthem. And then immediately, where do I sign to get the commercial? How much money? And then I got to train for the next Olympic. Then I spend all the money. Then all my relatives want the money. Then they're immediately under total stress the next second. Or any pleasure. Think about it. Good sex. Then what? You got to have a cigarette in the old days. Now, I don't know what you do if you're a vegan. I don't know. You choose some vegan tobacco. I don't know what you do. Right away, afterwards. Think about how much better it might have been if I was a yogi. So that's the suffering of change. And the basic suffering is because you and the universe are different. And you think you're really you. As my old Lama used to say, you're right that you're real. That's not wrong. But your problem is you think you're really real. And you're exaggerating the degree of reality. You think you're absolutely real, and you're only relatively real. And your absolute sense of you're absolutely real makes you think you're more important than the rest of it. And guess what? Nobody else agrees with you. Not a single other person, or a germ, or a bug, or like a tick. They don't think you're more. Well, they kind of think you're, they like the bloodstream. But they don't think you're more important. So you're in a state of contradiction with the entire universe. So you invent some God who thinks you're really great, maybe. But usually, unfortunately, then the high priest tells you God thinks you suck. And then you're even more nervous. So point is, temporarily someone can think you're great, and then they fall in love with you. And ideally, you fall in love with them. And the two of you, harmonize each other. Oh, you're the one. Instead of each one going, oh yeah, my Lama used to say, long before the Matrix, used to say, everybody goes around secretly thinking, I'm the one. They all think that. So when I saw, Neo go around saying, who's the one in the Oracle? Oh, he's the one. I had to laugh, So everybody thinks that. But then when you're in love with somebody, then they say, yeah, you're the one. And then you think they're the one. So then the two of you, finally some corroboration. But the result is that everybody else hates the two of you because you so manifestly disagree with them that they're the one. They're all jealous, and then, the Montagues and the Capulets, and they do you in if you persist in the mutual delusion of each of you is the one for too long. And, of course, what happens when you get into that euphoria of having someone agree with you that you're the one, unfortunately, what tends to happen is you get all carried away, you do get swept away, and then somebody else shows up. And then they say, no, neither of you are the one, I'm the one. But, I don't know, if you don't get it, you don't get it. And in the middle of the love fest, there's another person who shows up, sometimes triplets. We're the ones. So the first noble truth is, as long as it's you versus whoever, even your God, you versus whoever, there'll be bigger God, you won't be God forever, it's still a relational state, anything that relates to it, anything else is relational, and therefore it will not be satisfactory. Suffering itself, we know, the suffering of suffering, we know, and then there's something called the suffering of creation, which is like the cosmic situation. And that's to include those states of infinite space and absolute nothingness, etc. Because they're made by causes, then they will be destroyed. What is created by cause will eventually has the seeds of its own destruction in it. Okay. And nirvana, however, what Buddha discovered. So that's the first noble truth. Second noble truth. So the first noble truth is the acknowledgement of the symptom. It's like a medical thing. Okay, there's this disease, there's this problem, this ease, lack of ease. Now, the cause of that lack of ease is the fundamental ignorance or really active misknowledge or misunderstanding of someone thinking they're the one, the universe is absolutely other, and therefore they have to try to fend off the universe with aggression, or they have to embrace and swallow the universe with greed or lust or desire, to sort of make them the one that I am bigger, to sort of hold off the universe. But the universe is infinite, so you can't really hold it off, so that will fail. But greed and hatred and aggression, or greed and aggression, lust and hate, they come out of that fundamental thing of I'm the separate one, and I'm absolutely the separate one, and the universe is absolutely not me. And that fundamental thing is the source of that suffering, right? So that's the diagnosis. The prognosis is what we started with, third noble truth. It's actually nirvana is the reality of it, meaning being blown away. Nirvana means being blown away. Again, the hipsters come to our rescue of our uptight Anglo culture, being blown away. When you say you went to the concert, you went to the thing, you said, how was it? And you say, I was blown away. And that means you were lifted out of yourself. Right? You mean by that? You don't mean you were killed, you died. You mean you let go of it, you let it all go. Right? How, you know, how they get in rock and roll, they get the mosh pit, you know, like maybe you did get hurt in the mosh pit, but you know, it was like you were blown away. You let go of your usual thing, the self preoccupation habit cycle, where you're thinking, how am I doing? Am I safe? Is it okay? Is this vegan? Can I eat that? Is there a tick in there? What's it? Is there a bug here? Where? Temperate blown away means, whoa, why do I care? Type thing, right? To whatever degree. So nirvana means blown away permanently. And that's reality, is that. And so it's not a cause thing. It's very complex there to try to explain how to achieve it, because it's not caused. Nirvana has always been the case, is the point. It has no cause. It was always the case. The failure to understand it is the cause of not experiencing it, but consciously experiencing it. But it's always been the case. So when you do attain nirvana, and I will come back to this maybe in the next day or two, maybe on Sunday, when you do understand it, it's a weird understanding where it's like you understand something, and you've all had that type of understanding. You understand something, you learn something, which then when you learn it, oh, I always knew that, you know, but I wasn't listening to some layer in myself that knew it. You know, you have this kind of, you know, the deja vu kind of thing, deja new, you know, who knew, you know, people say on the West Side, they say, who knew? Meaning I always knew that. Everybody knew that. But when you sort of learn it in a certain way, then you kind of do a deeply experience. You know it experientially in some way. And that, you know, so there's a way of arranging the causal thing where you're then open to what your actual reality is, rather than you somehow get your reality. Because in a way, you can't get your reality with your unreality in a funny way. Do you know what I mean? It's like you have a concept of eating an apple, and you have a concept of an apple. And you know, but eating an apple, when you actually are eating it, it kind of goes beyond all your concepts. Poets can go for 1,000 years describing the delicious apple, and eating an apple, and they never exhaust it. So your concept of eating an apple, that's how the British Empire collapsed in India, because of the mango. You know, the British servant class that had, you know, they were sitting up there with their thing. Have you ever been in a high British table, an Indian table, you know? They still have some vestige of it. You know, they're there with the waiters in those fancy hotels in India. And they were there. And then those British lords are like, Mr. Uptight, you know, with their little horse whip and this and that. And then when the mangoes came out, they had to put out like a lobster bib, and then they were slurping up that mango. And then they saw, oh, these are human beings. Well, that's it. I'm digressing, I know. But the reason that India was the place Buddha chose to demonstrate his teaching is that they were more open to being open before they were too conquered. Because they were more wealthy. It was more like a garden. It was the Garden of Eden. The Indus Valley was Garden of Eden. But really. And it still will be again if they get back to taking care of the lower people. They try to do now and then. So, So, because there's something very blessed and natural about it. Okay, so second noble truth is the diagnosis, prognosis. Then the therapy is the fourth noble truth. By the way, these are all called noble truths because they're true for a noble person. And then there's Buddha's brilliance. The word noble, Arya, had been in his time a class term. It was applied to the three upper classes, the ones who could go to church, the Vedic church. The majority of the people couldn't go to that church. They were not noble in the class use of the term. And even earlier, it was a race term because there was a conquest in the third millennium before the and second millennium before the common era. And there was a kind of domination thing, racial thing. But by Buddha's time, it had become a class thing. And so noble is the right word. And he redefined noble. He said, noble is not your birth, where you're born in the upper class. It's not. That's not what noble is. Noble means someone who has true compassion, true empathy for others. So that, and not just a theory of empathy, but a feeling, experience of empathy. They feel the reality of the other's heartbeat, of the other's suffering, of the other's pleasure. They really feel the feelings of the others. Like Bill Clinton. If he really was speaking the truth when he said he could feel your pain, he would have been noble. And I shouldn't say that because then we have to decide whether we think so. Never mind. So the point is that that's what noble came to mean, because then you feel the other's feeling, then you become more ethical. You take them into consideration in how you act and what you do. You don't want to harm them. You want them to feel better. So you have noblesse oblige about them. So noble is a cognitive term for Buddha, meaning someone who has gone past that level of self-enclosure where they're only, I'm the one, is just so much preoccupied with themselves that they kind of, the other one is like, they don't know if it's an illusion or not. They don't really feel, they can make a theory about I should be concerned about them, but they don't really feel their situation. And enlightenment in Buddhism is not just entering some vast space or seeing some vast light, or even awakening to some other thing only. Enlightenment in Buddhism is realizing that since this is the absolute, this is nirvana, then all the beings in it are nirvana. Nirvana doesn't destroy those beings. And I can see it doesn't destroy their perception and misperception of themselves as being in pain. And therefore, their pain is the absolute concern of nirvana. In other words, anybody who's in nirvana but doesn't enjoy that being in nirvana, helping them enjoy it becomes the only thing a noble person wants to do. Because they themselves, and true love, by the way, true love, not love mixed with greed and wish for to possess, but true love that is so into the beauty of the beloved that wants the beloved to be happy, that's all it wants, true love, can only occur if the lover is truly happy themselves. To whatever degree they're happy themselves, they then see the beloved as deserving of that happiness, and then they want them to have that happiness. If you have no happiness yourself, and you're a complete misery case, oh, I love you. Thanks. What do you want? Do you want to be fed? You want to be taken care of? You know, what would that mean? Could that mean I want you to be happy? And I'm so miserable? I don't think so. Because I wouldn't know what being happy was. So that can only be possessiveness, if you follow me. In Buddhism, love is defined as the will to the happiness of the beloved. Compassion is defined as the will to free the beloved from the suffering. Free the other from the suffering. So that's what enlightenment is. And it's logical, you can see. Imagine yourself becoming a Buddha right now. Okay? That would mean that you would realize now that here and now you are in nirvana and you are nirvana. But unfortunately, you can't realize that as your private possession because you can't possess that nirvana in a way. It possesses you. You know, when you're really blown away, you expand, you know. So you merge, you melt into that nirvana. Bliss is a kind of melting. So you melt into that nirvana. And then in melting into that nirvana, that destroys the sense of difference between yourself and the other. So imagine that you're a Buddha, you're now in nirvana, then you feel everything here is nirvana. Everyone else here is nirvana. And at first, of course, I think you might be a little bit flipped out. You might be speechless even. You'd be so disoriented from your previous habits of orientation. But then one thing it would begin to impinge upon you. You'd begin to notice. You might even make the mistake that some people do, where they rush up to somebody and say, "Oh, you're so beautiful, you're nirvana." And they go, what's the matter with you? Are you crazy? Leave me alone. You never want to try to hug a paranoiac. They perceive it as a smackdown, and they want to defend themselves. So then you recoil from that, then doing that, and then you're there and you see them as bubble of bliss, feeling all deprived and miserable. Then how to communicate to them their deeper nature? How do you communicate that to them? That becomes your sole concern, because you wouldn't get that understanding of being nirvana if you hadn't freed yourself from any concept that there's anything outside, elsewhere, that is your nirvana. You would realize this here is it, and you're here in it with everybody. And anybody who doesn't know it is really deprived, and you have nothing better to do. You have nothing to do, actually, because you're perfectly fine, but they keep kind of irritating them because you feel their irritation themselves. Because they're irritated. And you can't even tell them, actually, all of them. Some of them you can't even tell this is nirvana. Because they would either misunderstand that to mean that nirvana sucks. And there's no way out of it. They can't escape. And so then they become bitter and disillusioned and cynical, or they might become very self-indulgent in their non-nirvana experience. And there's various ways they would misunderstand that. So the non-duality thing took time to unfold in Indian history, although it was taught right away by the Buddha. It took time to unfold. When you can find it in Theravada, it's hinted, but it's not really. And he taught Mahayana right away, we think. So now, Eightfold Path. So Eightfold Path first branch is not meditation. Last branch is meditation of the eight branches. First branch is what they call realistic view. You could translate view as belief even, but it's more experiential if you call it view, which is better. So realistic view, worldview, realistic worldview, Weltanschauung. Second branch is realistic purpose or motivation, life purpose or motivation. Third branch is realistic action. Fourth branch is realistic speech, which is a very signally important type of action. Fifth branch is realistic livelihood. Sixth branch is realistic creative effort or creativity. Seventh branch is realistic memory, remembering, which is nowadays called mindfulness in English. And finally, eighth branch is realistic samadhi, which means concentrated meditation. But the first, and so it's a whole curriculum. Those eight can be categorized as three educations: higher education in ethics, higher education in mind, and higher education in wisdom or reality, knowledge of reality, which is what wisdom means. Wisdom doesn't mean resignation or sort of dropping out that you can't know reality or this kind of thing. Sometimes people wrongly think. Wisdom means total knowledge of reality. And that was another wonderful thing about the Buddha, I think. He said, yeah, I know everything now. I got it. I know, I understand everything. And it's really great. Don't worry. Smiling away, feeling happy, radiant. I know everything. But it doesn't do you that much good to think that I do. So don't believe me just because I say that. He said, yeah, I do, but don't believe it. And even if I look cute or radiant or have like long earlobes or whatever, can radiate lights, Don't believe it. Some other one will come up and make more cute things, then you'll believe that. I do understand everything, so therefore I know that a human being is capable of understanding everything that they need to understand. But it doesn't. It's not your method to do it, believing that I'd do it. What you need to do as a human being is you need to understand everything, and you can understand everything. That's very amazing. Who else tells you you can understand everything? Did you notice any authorities telling you you can understand everything for yourself? Have you ever noticed that? When I was a young kid, I didn't like my minister in the church I went to play basketball and sing. And because he said, no, you can't understand. God understands, but you can't. You have to believe whether it makes sense to you or not. I didn't like that. I rejected that. And then I went to science classes, and they said, oh, yeah, you can analyze this and understand and do this to that frog and this and that to Adam, and blah, blah, blah. And the Big Bang, so I didn't even doing much on banging in those days. But you can't, no one understands everything. Oh, no. Einstein, he didn't come up with any grand unified theory. So also you can't understand. But you can understand a little more about this. But, you know, when you learn more about this, then you know more about what you don't know. So your ignorance increases. That's the basis of science. Which comes from skios, to know, Greek, you know. Skiri, or whatever it is. Means you expand your ignorance by studying little pieces of things. I mean, that's really pathetic. I felt, as a young kid, because our adolescents all wanted to think they know everything. I agree. I realize I was a silly boy. But I like the idea that you can and you have to. And salvation comes from your understanding your reality, because your reality is saved. It's not you're going to be later. It is saved. It is free of suffering. That's your reality. And you're fighting that reality is what makes you suffer. Right, because you don't know that, so you're afraid to let it all go. So therefore, you know, which means, you know, all ethics, for example, it means let it go, you know. The three main ethical virtues, generosity, morality, and patience, tolerance. Generosity is the ability to let go of possessions. You know, ethics is letting go of your point of view and letting other persons be unharmed, you know. And patience is when you're injured by another, not seeking revenge, letting go the injury, letting go the vengeance, letting go the anger. You know, so everything that makes you more open to reality improves your ethical manifestation. So ethics actually there's an enlightened self-interest in being ethical about others, actually, which doesn't mean that altruism and this kind of thing is useless and it's unreal and really everybody's selfish. It means that reality is such that when you are helpful and loving others, it benefits you, which makes you more intense in your helping others. So it's a win-win. What's wrong with that? Some psychologists go around and make a big fuss. Oh, that means everybody's selfish. Because when you're kind to others, you get something out of it. You don't get something out of it if you want something out of it. You don't. If you say, oh, I was kind, they didn't say thank you. Oh, I hate them now. I'm not going to help them next time. Then it makes you worse. But if you just do it because they need it, then you feel better yourself, for sure. So, okay, so realistic worldview. Now, you might think realistic worldview or realistic belief means believing in Buddha. It doesn't. It doesn't mean believing in Buddha. It doesn't mean believing in Nirvana. It doesn't mean any such thing. It means believing in causality. Whoops. How can that be? This is supposed to be a religion. The epitome of the Buddha's teaching, Om Ye Dharma Hetu Prabhava Hetun Tesham Tathagata Hi Abadat Tesham Jayo Nirodoi Vambadi Mahaswamini Swaha. That means of all things that arise from causes, He described the causes and also how to interfere with them. And this is the path taught by the great teacher, the great seeker. Oh, we're ending at 11:30, right? Oh, good. So we're almost free. So believe in causation. But why is that revolutionary to believe in causation? Well, in Buddha's time, in one level, it was revolutionary because people believed that the gods controlled them. They went to the Vedic priests to intercede with the gods. So the gods wouldn't, and they were scared of those Vedic gods, were pretty savage, actually, mostly. There was only one or two females. Two, actually, only two. The earth and the dawn. Something you walk on and something that wakes you up. And the rest were all male. And they wanted sacrifices. And the Vedic was just, Vedism was sacrificialism. It wasn't vegetarianism. It wasn't anything that modern Hinduism is at all. It was a sacrificial ritual thing, cult managed by sacrificial priests. And so causation means that the gods are not in charge. It means that causes are you're the situation of whether you have prosperity or poverty, whether you have happiness or suffering. These are caused by causes. So you can understand what are the causes of the bad states, what are the causes of the good states. You prevent the causes of the bad states, you reinforce the good states. You begin to try to gain more responsibility, control and responsibility of your own situation. And most importantly, everyone is miswired. The ignorance definition or the misperception definition is describing our animal with miswiring, which is that we all think we have a core that is an unchanged, absolute, essential entity. That's the real us. And therefore, that's the absolute. And therefore, that becomes the focus of the absolute concern. And that's the thing that's the main, that's me versus it. Remember, I went through that whole description. And so causation means that whatever deeper, subtler levels of soul or mind or anything that I have are relational. They are built up. My identity sense is built up out of my education, my culture, my experiences, and it can be changed. And it is changing all the time. And there's nothing about there that is not changing. I'm a total relational process. I'm a life stream. I'm a flowing process. And I'm afraid of that maybe because I want to think, oh no, I'm some fixed thing in there. And I'm going to get that fixed thing and put it in a fixed thing outside, which will be Nirvana or the heart of God or with Beatrice in paradise or with Krishna or something, somebody elsewhere, you know, will save me. And that'll be that sort of thing. I don't want to be part of the flow because I'm afraid if I am, I'll flow into unpleasant places. So there's this miswiring which we defend. So a full acceptance of causation means that anything, that, you know, just what it would mean to say I have an absolute thing inside me. How can it be absolute if it has a location? If it's inside and not outside. That's what how you talk about relative things. Absolute means it's not relational. That's the opposite of relational. So the feeling I have of my own self-absoluteness is clearly an error. Even logically, you can understand that. You can totally understand that. It's simple even. It's not even rocket science. So a true acceptance of causation is a beginning at the, yes, intellectual level, but intellectual is not non-experiential. I'm sorry. We shape our experiences through our concepts. If we have distorted concepts, we have distorted experiences. A racist has a distorted experience about that other race, concept about it. And that concept filters their experience of that person and it becomes always self-fulfilling. Oh, yeah, that one's inferior. Oh, that one's no good. Oh, that one's stupid. Oh, that one doesn't deserve to live in its worst state. Okay? So concepts are not, you know, this whole American thing about, oh, I don't want to hear about intellectual. I want experience. Your experience is dominated by your conceptual network. So you should understand that. So accepting causation means you accept that you are a constantly flowing process. When you accept that, you gradually more and more become responsible, then you might become a yogi. You might become responsible for how flowing am I? Do I have like a cramp over here and that? And what? The big cramp is the cramp around my absolute me, my absolute Bobness. Some of my students was put a cartoon on my office door of some chicken is going, there he goes. Two chickens are watching some other rooster going somewhere. And the rooster's there. They say, there he goes, bobbing along. There's my absolute Bobness in there. And we say, well, we know we're not absolute in there, where there's no homunculus in there, we know. But subliminally, subconsciously, we don't know that, actually. We operate as if there's an absolute there, and it comes out in life and death situations. that mine is absolute. If I'm only relative, it's only relative. It doesn't mean it's absolutely unimportant. It just means it's relational. It means that your life is just as important as mine. It means that we're all related, interrelated. It means that I have to be responsible in shaping. It means that then Buddhist societies, education, Buddhist societies are not everybody's meditating in them. Everybody's meditating in all societies. What's wrong with our society? Everybody's meditating Fox News, CNN. All the time, 14 hours, and more important than them, even, is commercials. And news is not even news anymore. It's just more commercials. And so we're meditating. One kind of commercial causes dissatisfaction. The other kind of commercial causes fear. And we're all meditating that all the time. Buddhist societies are totally focused on education. Education means if you are a self in flux, if you are flux, then how you shape that flux is all important to your life and your experience. So you want to shape it well. So you want to learn from those who did shape theirs well how to do it. Plato doesn't have to be just Buddha. It can be Confucius. It can be Plato. It can be the Upanishadic teachers. It can be Jesus. It can be anybody. You know, Moses. It becomes all important to you to be actively. Therefore, the mindfulness craze is a very good thing. There's some Buddhist purists who are all fussy about it, or they're not doing exactly what Buddhists do. Doesn't matter. Being more aware of their own process means they become more responsible for their own states. How many times did you hear somebody say, yeah, I'm so depressed and I'm so mad. Why? Oh, because so-and-so did something. So they helplessly have to react to some external thing, whatever it is. Godzilla on top of the Empire State Building. So I'm depressed. Well, there's always going to be some Godzilla somewhere. Micro Godzilla might jump out and give you Lyme disease. So point is, when do people say, I'm depressed because I'm letting my mind go like that? I'm narrating to myself a whole depressing narrative that says that's all useless, all helpless. I'm letting some voice internalized in me from a kind of depressed parent, a depressed uncle, a depressed TV announcer, a depressed radio spokesperson who blabs away about how awful everything is. So acceptance of causality as a starting is a very, very realistic starting point. But where does, so therefore, you know, people always ask me, what is Buddhism? We'll come back to this more. We'll talk about it more also in dialogue with KD this afternoon. In a very short phrase, Buddhism is engaged realism. That is actually what it is. Based on the discovery that reality is great. The more you know it, the more blissful you will be. Ignorance is the opposite of bliss. Ignorance is the cause of suffering. And wisdom is the cause of bliss, the opposite of ignorance. Okay? So don't be afraid to be open to reality. But we have all authoritarian societies ingrained in the populace, a feeling of fear of reality, so that they can step in between and say they'll intercede for you. The high priest will, the king will, the CIA will, the KGB will. They'll intercede with this very dangerous reality and they'll save you. They all ingrained that in us, and all our cultures are ingrained in that, including the Indian culture to some extent, but Indian less, because they were more blessed, actually, basically, in that ancient time. It was the Garden of Eden. So, okay, have a nice afternoon. First, before you quite go, let's meditate for 2 minutes. Go back to the refuge setting field, your own personal meditative shrine space. And all those enlightened beings are up there, Confucius, all the Zen masters, all the Buddhist masters, the Buddha, all the Buddhas, Jesus, Moses, Rabbi Hillel, Socrates, Pythagoras, whoever it is. They're all up there, plus my Latin teacher in the third grade, Mr. Fry, and Mr. Manders. They're all up there, blessing us. And then whatever, and they're very happy. And then what they do at the end of a session, and this is how you close a session, you imagine that those beings, your mentor beings, whoever they are, the mentor host, they're so happy to see that you learned something, that you thought about something, that you had a little insight about something, that you had a little enthusiasm, inspiration about something, that they can't stand just radiating light to you. They melt into light themselves, flow down themselves, and unify themselves, express their feeling of oneness with you by taking up their residence in your heart. They're there in you, in your heart, indivisible from you, as energy and light and blessing. And then you want to take up that spirit, and you see all the beings around you who are looking at you glowing from this blessing light and felt blessed by you. And you dedicate whatever virtue you or merit you accumulated, a virtue you accumulated, wisdom you accumulated in this session of meditation or session of learning, to everyone's realization of their own reality of Buddhahood, of nirvana, freedom, and bliss. And you melt into light, and you flow out into all of them and express your feeling of oneness with your loved ones, with your mere acquainted ones, and even with your enemies. And you become one with them. And you let yourself melt and disappear. Now you let your meditative self melt and disappear, like at the beginning you let your habitual self meditate and disappear. So you let your meditative self disappear, and you spread your light, invest your light in the heart and mind and soul of all the beings, and let yourself just give it up. And then one of your loved ones, maybe, or maybe one of your rivals or somebody, you sort of hear them thinking, hey, where did so-and-so go? Where did Bob go? Maybe he was just shining over there, and then he suddenly, there's a burst of light, and he disappeared. Where's Bob? And then you're back, your regular, ordinary self, ready to go to lunch. So that's how you close that field at the end of the session. And then you're back in sort of relational, normal, habitual reality, somewhat. And you have whatever you gained in any learning or out of any meditating or out of any insights, you sort of give it over to all beings. You make it an altruistic thing. You don't hoard it yourself. That's a great thing. It's called dedication and closing the field of blessing, field of refuge, the jewel tree. Okay? Okay, thank you.